Welcome, everybody, to the fourth lecture of the Mises Academy Econ 730 class, Keynes, Krugman, and the Crisis. We are getting into the really good stuff now. We've just gotten over discussing Keynes' work and the general theory, and now we're getting into today's topic is Hyde versus Keynes. As always, you can get the PowerPoint slides, for those of you just joining us. The URL is in the chat box. Okay, so let me just spend a few moments talking about the rap videos. I just in Freedom Fest there, I was with the chief creator of it, John Papola or Papola. I always forget how to pronounce his last name. But anyway, John P, let's call him, was down there. And so in case you didn't know this, he's actually a really cool guy, and he is hip deep in the Austrian literature and is just doing lots of reading. And he, you know, he saw me and he was like, Bob, we got to talk about this monetary disequilibrium stuff. And so it was pretty surreal that we were sitting in the corridor between the Bally's Hotel in Paris, drinking beers in the corridor there and talking about Selgin and White and all that stuff. But in any event, let me just mention, There are two criticisms I've heard, so one from the Keynesian camp and one from the Austrian camp regarding these videos. So I just want to make you aware of them, because in the grand scheme of things, I mean, these videos are amazing. The fact that they're kind of entertaining and that's actually, you know, I especially like the first song, like I can actually have that playing in the background and it's kind of catchy. But beyond that, they're pretty good in terms of laying out the positions of the two camps, but let me just mention two criticisms I've heard. So one from the Keynesian camp is that especially the second video, they don't like it because they say, hey, at one point, I don't remember the exact words, but Hayek says, I reject your central plan or something like that. And so they get upset because they're saying, hey, Keynesians are not central planners, and in fact, John Maynard Keynes himself thought he was defending the market economy. That if people dogmatically clung to the doctrine of laissez-faire in the face of massive unemployment, then the workers aren't going to sit around and wait 5 years for markets to fix themselves. They're going to go and give their support to a dictator who's going to, you know, actually implement socialism in some form or another. So I've heard that complaint. And then from the Austrian side, I won't say who the guy's name was, but one of the attendees at Freedom Fest, when I was talking to John, came up and complained to him, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, saying, hey, I didn't like the way that you likened Keynesianism to drinking a lot, like a drinking binge, because that's not fair to drunks, right? That you're giving drinking a bad name by linking it to Keynesianism, all right? So he was complaining in that respect. All right, so... And that's, I'm not saying that for, I mean, I am saying it for a joke, but that really did happen when I was down at Freedom Fest. Okay, a little bit more serious now. Let's move on to the next slide, Hayek on Keynes. So what I mean here with this YouTube link, I'm saying right now I'm talking about what was one of the assigned materials for today's lecture was the YouTube where there's an interview with Hayek and he's talking about Keynes. Now, it was a little bit hard to make out some of Hayek's words on that video, but now if I'm telling you what he was talking about, if you want to go back and listen to it again, you might be able to make more sense of it. Like, I know myself, the first time I listened to it, I only caught about 80% of it just because he was kind of speaking softly and his accent was strong. But then once I figured out what he was talking about, and then having read the selection from Tiger by the Tail, where he's talking about a lot of the same concepts, but you can see the printed word. And then when I went back and listened to it again, it was crystal clear what Hayek was saying. So anyway, if you care and you had difficulty listening to it the first time through and gave up on it, after you hear my explanation, maybe you want to go back and try again, because it's actually what he's saying makes sense. Okay, so the first thing he talks about when the guy interviewing him asks Hayek, what do you think about the British government's policies during the 30s, and how do you feel about that, and were they responsible for what happened? Hayek says, I don't remember the exact words, but he says something like, well, we have to go back further than that. This story doesn't start in the 1930s. So let me just give you a little bit of the explanation there of what he's talking about. And this is something that also that Ludwig von Mises thought was a serious blunder, as Mises puts it, when he doesn't like what somebody does, he calls it a serious blunder, of what the British government did. And they think that this was it gave the gold standard a bad name that it didn't deserve. All right, so what happened was, on the eve of World War I, Great Britain, the United States, and all the other major world powers were on the classical gold standard. So for the U.S. and Great Britain in particular, let me not take anything for granted. Let me spell out some stuff. This is going to be elementary for a few of you, but I want to make sure I'm not leaving anybody behind here. So let me just make sure we all understand how the classical gold standard worked. So the classical gold standard was a regime of fixed exchange rates. So that strikes some of us as odd, because in our times with fiat money, free market people following Milton Friedman, Milton Friedman had a good essay on this, arguing for freely floating exchange rates. And Friedman said, just like we wouldn't want the government declaring, you know, what the price of potatoes should be, and if the government tried to fix the price of potatoes, that could lead to shortages or to surpluses, depending on whether they put a price ceiling or a price floor. By the same token, this is Friedman talking, we don't want governments trying to control the price of their currencies. Just let, you know, so if the dollar is going to fall against the yen, so be it, that you're only going to cause a shortage or a surplus in the foreign exchange market if you come in and put in a price control. Okay? So that's correct as far as it goes, if what we mean is the government levying a fine or throwing you in jail if they catch you trading the currency outside the officially approved your price range. But people like Mises and Murray Rothbard and Ron Paul and so forth, when they say they want to put the dollar back on gold, of course what they mean is they're going to lock in the dollar price of gold so that people who have a certain amount of dollars can turn them into the government or to the Federal Reserve and get a certain specified weight of gold in return. And the point of that is to limit the inflationary ability of the government or the central bank, right? That they can't print with reckless abandon new amounts of currency, because they know if they do that and that pushes up what the market price would otherwise be, then speculators will come in and turn over the currency in exchange for the gold, and they'll run out of gold. And so it ties their hands. All right, so that's what the function of the gold standard is. So now if a bunch of countries are doing that, if they each tie their own domestic currency to gold in a fixed ratio where a certain weight of gold trades for a certain number of units of their currency, well, then that means on the foreign exchange market, those currencies trade against each other in a specified ratio, right? Because just arbitrage, if they moved too far away from each other, then there'd be arbitrage opportunities that you would buy one, the undervalued currency, or sorry, the overvalued currency, what would you do? You'd sell the overvalued currency for gold and then turn gold into the other country for that thing's currency or something like that. Right? I'd have to write out the example to say it correctly. But the idea is if each thing is tied to gold at a certain ratio, then those currencies have to trade against each other in terms of multiplying those ratios together. All right, so for example, and so here I'm looking at the first paragraph of this PowerPoint slide. What you had on the eve of World War I is roughly 4.25 British pounds exchanged for 1 ounce of gold, and roughly $20.67 of U.S. currency traded for an ounce of gold. So that meant in the foreign exchange market, what was called the cable rate, or the sterling dollar, the how much a British pound would trade against a U.S. dollar, that exchange rate was roughly $4.86 per pound. Okay, so that was what would be called the pre-war parity for the classical gold standard. All right, so then what happened is during World War I, all of the belligerents except the United States officially went off gold. right? Because they were running the printing press to pay for the war effort, and so what would have happened is the think of it in terms of the British pound, the market prices of goods in Britain were going up because the Bank of England, was creating a lot of new pounds, and then buying government debt with it, so the government could run massive deficits to buy munitions and ships and war supplies in general, that sort of stuff. Okay, so in general, you're running a printing press like crazy to pay for a war. What's going to happen? Prices are going to start rising, including the price of gold. So as the price of gold starts going up above 4.25 pounds per ounce, then all of a sudden traders can turn pounds in to the Bank of England, get gold, and then sell gold in the open market for more than 4.25 pounds. And so they increase their money that way. It's an arbitrage, right? Bank of England is selling gold for less than the market's buying it. Obviously, people are going to rush and turn in their pounds for gold. All right, so the Bank of England didn't want to run out of gold, so it just suspended its redemption policy. It said, okay, for the war, right now we're off gold. And that's what all the major countries did, except the United States. The United States also was printing a lot of money, and there was massive price inflation. At one point it was like 20% a year, but they technically stayed on the gold standard. I mean, they did some stuff around the edges, but they formally didn't just abandon it the way the other major belligerents did. Okay, so the problem is the war ends, and now the British government, because remember, at the time, the British Empire, the British government was still a powerhouse, and it's true the United States by this point, militarily was coming out of the scene, and we were getting ushered into the century of the United States, but still London was the financial center of the world. New York was starting to rival it, but still historically London was supposed to be the financial center of the world. That's where, the heart of Western civilization in terms of capitalism and commerce was. So for various reasons, just in terms of prestige, and also probably because they thought international investors would need to be reassured, the British government announces that, hey, we're going to go back to gold. We're going to tie the pound back to gold now that the war's over. And crucially, we're going to go back to the pre-war parity. So not only are we tying the pound back to gold, but we're going to do so at roughly 4.25 pounds per ounce. All right. So one way of saying it is they're going to say we're going to go back to gold to go back to the so that the pound now gets $4.86 U.S. in the foreign exchange markets. That's what we're going back towards. So they didn't actually get to that point until 1925, right? So this is confusing for some people because if you're reading some stuff, it'll say Great Britain went back to the gold at the pre-war parity in 1925. But then if you hear Hayek in this interview, if you listen carefully, he says Great Britain went back to the gold standard in 1920. All right, and so I think what's going on here is that the British government announced early on, I don't know the exact date, but 1920, 1921, somewhere in that range, they announced we're going back to gold, and they just gave themselves a window. And so they didn't actually get back to the pre-war parity until 1925, but the point is all along they were moving towards it. Like the market knew it was coming, and so the Bank of England had to get ready and had to get its house in order so that by 1925 they wouldn't get wiped out. And there wouldn't be a run on the Bank of England to drain all of its gold reserves. Right, so I couldn't capture it and put it on a slide, but there are, if you look at charts showing the exchange rate between the U.S. dollar and the British pound in the 1920s, you'll see that early on, like in 1921, I found a chart, like in January of 1921, the exchange rate was $3.64 for a British pound. And it bounces around a little bit, but it generally goes back up to finally leveling off again at $4.86 a pound. Okay, so you can see, just think about what that means. As of 1921, the British pound only fetched $3.64, whereas before the war, it had fetched $4.86. So that's showing that the pound had lost about 25% of its value, at least vis-a-vis the dollar, in the intervening years. Okay, because Great Britain, the Bank of England, had inflated more than the Federal Reserve had. All right, so that's what Hayek is talking about now. He says, so what the problem here is, prices and wages in Britain had risen with the inflation. Now, if the Bank of England wants to go back and make the pound strengthen to the pre-war parity, there has to be deflation, right? Because we used inflation, we created a bunch of pounds to push up prices and wages. Now we want to go back to the way it was. The only way to do that is to have a monetary tightening, a contraction, and push down prices and wages. So the problem was that trade unions had gotten pretty powerful in Great Britain by this point, and they resisted nominal reductions in wages. They didn't want the absolute amount in terms of pounds that their workers got paid. They didn't want that number going down. And so that's a problem if, in general, you're trying to lower the price level. So specifically, here, what happened was, in terms of what actually manifests itself, because it's not like the Bank of England literally said, oh, we need to lower the price level. I mean, it's not like they went out trying to push down prices per se. No, what they would do is, in order to strengthen the pound, they had to – now, I'm not sure if they actually shrank their monetary base or if they just didn't inflate and waited a couple of years for the pound to strengthen. I mean, my guess is that they did actually sell off assets and shrink the monetary base, but I haven't seen it with my own eyes. I don't know exactly what they did. But the point is, they had to have a tight monetary policy, raise interest rates, and not inflate, and possibly even literally deflating, meaning shrinking the amount of pounds in existence, in order to raise the foreign exchange rate, in order to make the pound go from, in 1921, fetching $3.64 to fetching $4.86. So if you just think that through, what does that mean? So now if Great Britain was originally in equilibrium in 1921, and now all of a sudden we're making its currency 25% stronger, that will actually be even more stronger, because it's, if you're going from 364 to 486, that's a bigger percentage increase than it was on the way down. So if you're going to do that, then all of a sudden British goods are really expensive to everybody else. Okay, because just think of this through. If the Bank of England is creating a bunch of pounds because they're writing checks on thin air, buying government debt so the British government can buy planes and bombers and warships and so forth, and prices and wages in Britain are going up, so long as the pound is losing its value against other currencies, that's not going to kill British exports, because from an American's point of view, yes, products in Britain, their prices are going up, but the dollar is getting stronger and stronger against the pound. And so from the American's point of view, the number of dollar bills you have to spend if you want to import something from Britain, the two effects offset each other. But now, starting in 1920, 1921, the pound starts appreciating. So that means if you're an American, something that before cost you £10 would have cost you, in 1921, it would have cost you $36.40 to buy, right? Because you would have, you get $3.64 per pound. So something that in Great Britain has a sticker on it saying this thing costs £10, in the United States, as of early 1921, that would cost you $36.40. Now, all of a sudden, if the pound strengthens so that a pound trades for $4.86, well, oops, now that thing that has a sticker of 10 pounds in Great Britain to the American importer now costs $48.60, because that's how many dollar bills you need to come up with to get yourself 10 pounds in the foreign exchange market, right? So a big, so from everybody else's point of view, when the pound is strengthening, that's equivalent to all the prices of goods in Britain going up by the same percentage. So that kills British exports. And so a lot of, so all the industries in Great Britain that were dependent on the export trade, they get crushed. So the, so that can, it can work, you know, if you do want to strengthen your currency, that's fine, but then what has to happen is prices and wages in, domestically need to be able to go down to restore equilibrium. And so that was the problem, that they were trying to strengthen their currency at the same time that wages in particular were what we would now call sticky, that they had downward nominal rigidities because of how strong trade unions had become. Okay, so there was massive unemployment, and that was the problem. So so that's what Hayek is talking about there. He's saying it was a very fateful thing because it sure felt like, oh my gosh, things were okay after the war. You know, we saw prices going up, but you know, we still were all employed. It was a humming wartime economy, and then these old fogies in the British government want to go back to gold and look at what's, it's just causing years and years of very high unemployment. Like throughout, you know, throughout the 1920s, Britain had this problem of high unemployment. And so, you know, if you want to discredit the classical gold standard, that's sure a great way to do it. That's what Hayek's point was. And what he said is that, you know, the issue, you didn't have to do that. That's what he was getting at when he said it was unnecessary. You can go back to gold. And he's saying that a lot of economists realize that, yeah, go back to gold, but go at, you know, at a different exchange rate. Don't go back to the pre-war parity. Just tie the pound, lock it in now to wherever it is, and go forward. And that's also what Mises recommends. I just wrapped up the study guide to theory of money and credit, and that should be available by mid-September. And Mises has the same thing in the final section there. He's got some essays that were written, I think, in the 1950s. Talking about monetary reconstruction, he says the same thing, that if a government has gone off gold and inflated a lot, it's foolish to insist that we go back to gold at the old parity. And he gives lots of reasons. He's saying he uses the analogy. He says that that's not undoing the effects of the inflation. He said that's just causing a bunch of unnecessary wrenching adjustment that hurts a whole new batch of people, and it doesn't necessarily undo the problems of the inflation. So, for example, somebody who bought a bond, like let's talk about it in terms of Great Britain. So it's true. Somebody in the year 1912, let's say somebody then bought a 50-year bond denominated in pounds, British pounds, and the person didn't realize that World War I was coming, didn't realize Great Britain was going to go off gold. So then World War I comes, Great Britain goes off the gold standard, starts printing pounds like crazy. And so now this person who's sitting on a bond that he bought in 1912 that entitled him to 50 years worth of payments of a certain amount of British pounds, well, the real value of that thing gets crushed, right, because of the inflation. And so then the person says, and he sells it. He sells the bond in exchange for, I don't know, an automobile or something. You know, he sells it for money and then buys an automobile. And then, and so he took a hit. All right. He got less for that bond when he sold it than he would have guessed he would get back in 1912. If he had looked forward and said, what if I sell this thing in a few years for an automobile? What can I, you know, what kind of automobile can I get? He's going to get a worse model vehicle than he would have thought, all right, because he wasn't anticipating all this inflation. So the or let's say radios. I'm getting my years mixed up. I don't know what kind of automobiles they would have had back then. All right, so the point is, if he gets out of pound-denominated assets and into a real good after this massive inflation hits and they go off gold, he's going to be worse off. Now, after the war, they go back, the British government announces, oh, you know, we reneged on our sacred pledges. We want to make things right. We're going to go back to gold at the pre-war parity and sort of, you know, pay for our sins during the war years. You know, it was unavoidable. We were fighting the Germans, but now we're going to go back. And we're going to make things right with the creditors around the world. Mises' point is, well, no, maybe somebody bought that bond in, whatever, the year 1918, fully taking into account the fact that the British government was off gold now, and now you're giving that person a gift. If all of a sudden you're going to have wrenching deflation and make the pound a lot stronger than it otherwise would have been. And so Mises says it's sort of like, you know, running over somebody with a car and then putting in reverse and backing up over them again. That you're not undoing the first accident, you're actually running over the person the second time. And that's what he said it's like if the government first inflates and then after the economy adjusts to that, now the government turns around and deflates. Okay, so that's what was going on there. And anyway, Mises says his proposal to go back to gold, so he wants to go back to gold. He's not saying that there's a problem with that. He's just saying there's nothing magical about going back to the original parity before a massive bout of inflation. He's saying just the important thing is to lock in whatever the price is right now, lock that down so going forward, the central bank can only print new money if it's fully backed by gold that's deposited with the central bank. So you're going to have 100% gold-backed currency, not in general, but in terms of any new currency that's created from this moment forward. And the point is to forever lock down the currency to gold exchange rate. All right, so that's what Hayek was getting at. And so with respect to Keynes, Hayek was saying Keynes during the 1920s used this opportunity to discredit the gold standard when really the fault was not with the gold standard per se. The fault was with the British government foolishly trying to go back to an unrealistic pre-war parity. And Hayek says, you know, even David Ricardo knew that it would be foolish to try to deflate in order to rescue a currency that had depreciated 30% against the precious metals. That's crazy. Okay, what else did Hayek talk about? He, in this video, he talks about this, and then he also mentions it in Tiger by the Tail, in that excerpt I gave for you guys. He says that he, you know, one of the mistakes of his career that he didn't really focus on the general theory when it first came out. And his excuse is to say, well, I didn't want to waste the time because I had written two very careful critiques of Keynes' earlier work, The Treatise on Money, which came out in December of 1930. All right, so Hayek wrote two, I think it was for Economica, I'm not sure, but I think it was for that journal. So a prestigious journal, when this important Treatise on Money comes out by John Maynard Keynes, who was, you know, people knew who he was. It wasn't like Keynes came out of nowhere in 1936 and published a general theory. People knew who he was. He was a big deal. And so it was a big deal when he comes out with his Treatise on Money in 1930. And so this reputable journal invites Hayek, who was a well-known critic of Keynes's views even at that point, hey, what do you think about this Treatise on Money that Keynes just put out? And Hayek says, oh, I put a lot of effort into writing these two things. And he said, by the time my second article criticizing his views was published, Keynes told me, oh, I don't believe that stuff anymore anyway. I've moved on with my views. And so Hayek thought, well, all right, this guy's a moving target, and he just keeps changing his mind, and he's sort of, you know, a brilliant but sort of a, you know, scatterdash thinker that he's just not, he doesn't sit down and carefully think through the argument. He kind of just throws off interesting observations and goes off on tangents and just keeps changing his mind. I'm not going to spend a ton of time refuting him. So in 1936, the general theory comes out, and Hayek said, I thought it was going to be a flash in the pan. I thought Keynes was just going to have his views evolve again. And also, Hayek says he thought it was a work just for that time in history, that he thought it was relevant because of the peculiar situation that the major powers found themselves in, where they were suffering from monetary deflation because there were financial panics. People were running on the banks, and so the money supply was shrinking in all the major countries. And so Hayek thought that, yeah, there is some scope there for Keynes's views, but it certainly was not a general theory, even though that's what the title was. So those are the reasons Hayek gave for why at the time he didn't think Keynes's book was going to catch on, and he didn't, you know, go into full attack mode. And then he said, like you said, later on he regretted that he didn't do it at the time. Okay, this was something that Hayek talked about in the video. I think he also talked about it in the selection from Tiger by the Tail. So let me just spell this out so you guys know what he's saying. So this quote here I got from the internet. So this quote was not directly from something you guys had. So this is Hayek talking. John Stuart Mill's profound insight that demand for commodities is not demand for labor, which Leslie Stephen could in 1878 still describe as the doctrine whose complete apprehension is perhaps the best test of a sound economist, remained for Keynes an incomprehensible absurdity. Okay, so what Hayek is saying here is that, if I just can paraphrase, he's saying, look at what Keynes is doing is resurrecting a fallacy that I thought we blew up in the 19th century. That John Stuart Mill, so in Mill's book on economic principles, there's a section with the title saying the demand for commodities is not the demand for labor. All right, so that's kind of like, you know, how Say's Law, there's that one section in Say's book that talks about what we now call it. So the same thing with Mill. Hayek is saying there's this section in his book that goes over this principle, and this guy Leslie Stephen in 1878 said, you're not a real economist if you don't understand what Mill's talking about here. And in fact, that's going to be my test, that if you understand what Mill's talking about here, then I think that you're a good economist. If you don't understand that, then you're not really an economist. And so Hayek is very frustrated because he's saying it's precisely this that Keynes doesn't get, that the analysis and the general theory completely overlooks. So what is he talking about? And I have to confess, when I, you know, Hayek says this a lot. He said it in that interview. He says it in the Tiger by the Tail, and then he says it here. When I hear this stuff, I actually get a little bit insecure because I'm thinking, well, gee, if he had just grabbed me 2 years ago and said, hey, what was John Stuart Mill's insight about the demand for commodities, not the demand for labor? I wouldn't have been sure. I'm not even sure that I read that part of Mill several years ago. All right. So anyway, for our class now, I went back to dig it up to see exactly what he was talking about, and it evolves in the different editions. You know, so when Mill's book, you know, went through several editions, this discussion changes a little bit. But I think just so you have some clue of what Hayek is talking about, let me just give you what I think is a fair summary from a 30,000 feet. Mill says, look, he used, at least early on, what was called this doctrine of the wages fund. So wages and then fund, F-U-N-D. So a fund out of which the capitalists pay the workers. So the idea here is, this is a very classical approach, is to say that the capitalists, they accumulate savings, so they have consumption goods, you know, food and clothing and so forth. They build up this stockpile of stuff, and then from that stockpile, that accumulated savings, they pay the workers. So the workers come to work. The workers want to get paid right away, but yet the worker might be working on a project that doesn't yield its fruits until the future. So the idea is the capitalists have to pay the workers out of the wages fund. And so what Mill is saying is that the only way, so the workers get paid and then they in turn try to buy stuff with their pay, and the demand for the products, if wages are flexible, then that will translate into the employer's demand to hire the workers. All right, so all the wages fund will get distributed among all of the potential workers if wages are flexible and all the workers get a job. If wages aren't flexible, well, then not all the workforce will be employed. And then, depending on how people spend their money, you know, the demand for the commodities, that will just influence the proportion, or it'll influence, yeah, the proportions of how the wages are distributed among the various components of the workforce who are employed. All right, so I know I said that confusing. Let me say it again. What Mill is getting at is the people, when consumers go into the retail shops to buy commodities, they are not literally hiring workers. They are first and foremost buying commodities. And so there's another step in the argument to say the employers who are selling the commodities now, they take those revenues and go out and try to hire workers. And the point is, if wages are flexible, then yes, they're going to hire all the workers. And if wages are inflexible, they're not going to hire all the workers. They're going to hire a subset. But the point is, how the people spend their money on commodities, that's not going to influence whether more or fewer workers get employed. No, that is influenced. That's regulated by the wage rate. Now, tell me how many workers are employed or not because of the wage rate, and then I'll tell you, depending on how people spend their money on various commodities, that will influence how the given workforce flows into the different sectors. So if people stop buying cigarettes and start buying Bibles, then yes, that will change the demand for labor in the sense that employers want to hire more people who make Bibles and hire fewer tobacco farmers. But still, that's not going to change the ultimate demand for labor in the first place, that it's not going to cause unemployed people to become employed. That decision is made, or that thing is regulated by whether or not wages are flexible. If wages are flexible, then you're going to hire all the available workforce, and if they're not, some people are going to remain unemployed. And the demand for commodities is just influencing the employed workforce. It's not influencing the size of the workforce per se. All right, so that is the sort of thing that Mill's talking about. And again, we're not going to get into it too much more in this class. If you want to try to go Google or go to your library and find it, it's an interesting discussion. It's sort of like, I think, J.B. Say's treatment, that if you go and you read Mill, I think you're going to agree with everything he says, but now in our modern times, people try to take it and plug it into their own framework, and depending on how you translate what Mill really was saying, it's either going to be true or false. Just like with Say, if you translate it a certain way, it's obviously wrong, but if you take a more nuanced approach, it's very deep, and it's obviously correct. So it's a similar kind of thing. But anyway, the important point for us here is that Hayek is saying this important classical insight that one guy thought was the mark of a good economist is absent from Keynes's work. Okay, Keynes on inflation. What was Hayek saying here? He was trying to defend. He was separating Keynes from the Keynesians, and this is a very popular theme. So this is not just a right wing attack, if you will. This isn't just Hayek making something up in order to discredit the legacy of Keynesianism. Even many Keynesians would say this. Okay, so there are many people who are fans of Keynes who refer to some of his followers as bastard Keynesians. And I remember that when Israel Kirzner at NYU was going over this in the history of economic thought, he got the real proper guy, and he said, no, don't misquote me. I didn't say they called them bastards. They called them bastard Keynesians. Okay, meaning that the people who, like John Hicks and Paul Samuelson, who just read the general theory and came away from it thinking it was all about ISLM curve and that sort of stuff, a lot of fans of John Maynard Keynes think that that's not really the message of the general theory. They think that there's a lot more stuff involved, especially his work on uncertainty and all that kind of stuff and liquidity preference, and they think that that mechanical ISLM framework really is, you know, it's like romper room for Keynes or something. All right, so for what, so what Hayek is, and we're going to talk more about that next week, but for right now, my point is just don't be suspicious. When Hayek says that John Maynard Keynes would not have agreed with what his disciples were doing, that's not a particularly controversial statement. Now, what is more controversial is for Hayek to be saying Keynes would have opposed their calls for inflation, that, you know, some other supporters of Keynes might have said, no, he would have been fine with that. So that's up for grabs. But the idea that Keynes might not have approved of what his disciples were doing in his name, a lot of people think that for different reasons. So here, Hayek is saying that when Keynes died, he was very concerned that inflation might start taking off, but that he assured Hayek, you know, if it does, I'm going to use my personal pull and my connections and my charisma and so forth with all the community of economists to make sure we nip that in the bud. But then, as Hayek says, ironically, Keynes died shortly after saying that. All right, so let me spend some time talking about Hayek's remarks in Tiger by the Tail. And in case you didn't catch that, Tiger by the Tail, that's not a book that Hayek sat down and wrote. It's was a collection of various scattered things he had done here and there that was put together by an editor. Also, let me mention, in case you don't get the metaphor, Hayek is saying that, so Hayek's really worried about inflation, in case that hasn't become clear to you guys. I mean, that's his big thing, and that's partly why he is so disappointed with the Keynesian system, is that he thinks it gives a green light for inflation. And so with Tiger by the Tail, what Hayek means by that metaphor is he's saying it's like we have a, you know, you have a tiger by the tail, just think about what that means. While you're hanging on to the tiger's tail, it can't get you, because if it tries to bite you, then, you know, its back moves and then it pulls you with the tail. And so as long as you're holding tight onto that tail, the tiger's not going to get you, but you're kind of in a bad situation, right? You don't ever want to find yourself holding a tiger by the tail, because if you let go, you're dead. The tiger's going to eat you. But if you hang on, you're still going to be dead eventually, because the tiger's just going to keep whipping around faster and faster, and eventually you're not going to be able to hold on anymore. Okay? So that's the so that's what he's getting at. So in terms of inflation, he's saying it's the same thing, that once the economy gets into a situation where it's dependent on ever-accelerating inflation just to maintain full employment, then you're dead. Because if you stop inflating, you're going to then, you know, the economy's going to crash and you're going to have to go through a wrenching adjustment period with high unemployment and resources getting reallocated. But it's also not a solution to just keep pumping in more and more money, because eventually, you know, price inflation is going to start taking off. People are going to start expecting price inflation, and then it's just going to outrun itself, and eventually the currency is going to collapse. So that's what he's saying, that the Keynesian system pushes us into there, and it's very naive and dangerous if we're in the midst of a slump to try to get out of it by printing money. But yeah, that might work temporarily, but then it's just going to set us up for a harder fall, and we can just keep doing that and pumping in more and more, but we're just setting ourselves up for an even worse crash, and we can't even just keep doing it indefinitely. So that's what I'm saying. I don't use the metaphor tiger by the tail, but that's the argument I use for our current system, or our current mess. I'm going to tell people, look, we had the dot-com crash in the United States, 2000-2001. Instead of suffering through that bad recession, Alan Greenspan pumped in a bunch of money, brought interest rates down to 1%, and set off the housing boom. So for those few years, yeah, you could argue people were doing better than if they had suffered through the recession that should have happened after the dot-com crash, but it was a false period of prosperity. And then it just set up the housing crash, which required a much more severe recession to get through, to recover from. And Ben Bernanke didn't want to, though. He pushed interest rates down to basically zero and pumped in a lot more money than Greenspan had done. So, yeah, things might have been better in 2009 because Bernanke did that than they otherwise would have been, but this is no long-term solution. Now we're just setting ourselves up for an even bigger collapse. And maybe, you know, governments are going to go down as opposed to just investment banks the next time around. And the point is, we can't, even if we wanted to, it's not an option just to keep pumping up bigger and bigger bubbles, because eventually the currencies will collapse and people will go back to barter. All right, so that's what Hayek is getting at here by the phrase tiger by the tail. Okay, so one thing that Hayek says here, and it's kind of a strong claim, and let me just explain what he means. He says at one point that he's actually praising Keynes in many respects, saying that Keynes was, you know, if you met the guy, he was very charming, he was very well read in terms of different types of literature, he was a collector of various things, he always was dabbling in all sorts of different things. You would have thought he was focusing on just one project, but he was always doing all sorts of other stuff. So, and he said something like, even if Keynes hadn't been an economist, we would have thought he was a great man. He said something like that. So very pleasant words about Keynes, and you might have been surprised by some of that. It seemed like they were arguably friends, at least good acquaintances. But in terms of economics, Hayek has some pretty harsh criticism. He says that Keynes was actually not a very sophisticated, well-trained economist. And that may have surprised you, because if you read the general theory, there's lots of, Keynes has clearly read a lot of economics. And so he goes through, not necessarily so much in the parts that I assigned for you guys, but if you have the physical book, just go ahead and flip through it and look. I mean, Keynes goes through, and he's always footnoting stuff. He's got whole appendices on the treatment of this topic by the orthodox economists, and he'll say, well, so-and-so does this in his book, and then Pigou does this, and then Marshall does this, and so-and-so does this. So Keynes has certainly read a lot of economics, and at first I was getting ready to tell you guys that Hayek was being unfair and that Keynes actually was well-read, but then, you know, last night I was looking over the stuff again to see exactly what Hayek said, and he didn't say Keynes hasn't read other economists. What he says is that Keynes read, for example, Mises' theory of money and credit with little profit or something like that. And that's true. And he said that that Keynes knew the English literature, but that when it came to the Swedes or the Austrians, that Keynes didn't know much at all. And that, I think, is correct. So Hayek wasn't necessarily saying that Keynes hadn't read that stuff. He was saying that clearly Keynes, it didn't make an impact on him. He did not get what those guys were talking about. And that, I think, is correct. So just to give you an example, in the general theory itself, at one point Keynes, in a footnote, I believe, explicitly refers to Mises, to what we now call the theory of money and credit, and Keynes is trying to explain Mises' views about the originary rate of interest and saving and investment and so on, and I don't even know what Keynes was saying. Like, so Keynes is trying to contrast his own view with that of Mises, and he doesn't quote Mises, he just says, you know, Ludwig von Mises, one of the leading Austrian economists, has a peculiar view when it comes to savings and interest rates. And he says, so Keynes is trying to paraphrase Mises' position, and then Keynes criticizes that. But I didn't even recognize what he was calling Mises' position. All right, so not only was that not Mises' position, but I could barely even understand why Keynes would think that was what Mises was saying. So So I agree with Hayek. You know, like I said, I was getting ready to defend Keynes's honor and say, no, he's very well read, but that's actually not what Hayek is saying. Hayek concedes that, yeah, maybe he read some of this stuff, but he clearly didn't get it. And that, I think, is definitely true, that Keynes does understand Marshallian economics, but when it comes to, and this is what Hayek also mentions, capital and interest theory, he's woefully deficient. So I think that that's correct, let alone is it a plausible thing to say. So, I mean, not only do I think Hayek should be given a green light for daring to say that, I think he actually is right. Okay, another thing Hayek talks about is Keynes' focus on aggregates. So here, Hayek's point is that Keynes is focusing on things like just labor in general or capital in general or investment, savings in terms of macro aggregates, total output, and then he's trying to come up with causal relationships among those things, when for Hayek the real difficulty in economic theory is to understand the micro relationships and how it is that particular relative prices change and bring about various adjustments in the economy. So without getting too deeply into it here, because you know this isn't a class on Austrian business cycle theory, but just to give you an example, in the Austrian theory of the business cycle, you can't even tell that story using a Keynesian framework. And I run into this problem when I was at NYU as a grad student, and people would ask, you know, kids in my program, or not kids, young adults in my program, would sometimes ask me, like, what is this Austrian stuff that you dabble in? And I try to tell them, and they would want to know, okay, well then, so why do you think there's a business cycle? And I realized they couldn't even get what I was saying, because in their models, there's only one good. That they have this one good called the capital stock that would be like a capital K, and then you'd plug that into a production function with labor, so there'd be like an F parentheses K comma L at close parentheses, so it was a function of capital and labor, and that, you know, that little F function, they would describe it, it would be continuous, and it would be, you know, its first derivative would be positive, its second derivative would be negative, that sort of thing, and that's the way they modeled the economy. And so you could have savings if you have output every period would be that Y equals the function of the capital and labor, and that would be total output. That would be like GDP. And then how much of that would you consume? And so you'd consume that, and that would go into the representative agent's utility function and give them some utility. And then whatever you didn't consume, that was your savings, that was your reinvestment, and so that was your K for next period, if that was the way you're doing it. Or rather, you would – K would be depreciated a certain amount, and then out of your savings, you could replenish the K. And so K would change based on how much you saved out of current output and whether or not you that more than offset the depreciation. Okay, but the point is there was only really one good, and that was the capital stock. So in that framework, you couldn't even tell the Austrian story, because I would tell people what the Austrians said, and they'd say, oh, so you guys think there's too much investment. And not really, because in their model, the Keynesian framework, if all you're looking at is investment, well, to say there's too much investment, I mean, the only problem would be that people might have to save more than they really wanted to. The you know, their consumption would go down this period. But you couldn't have an artificial boom, an unsustainable boom that would then lead to a crash, because in their model, there's no such thing as malinvestment. Because to talk about malinvestment, you need to have a structure of production. You need to have different types of capital goods. You can't just have capital. You have to have higher order and lower order goods, and the various components of the capital stock have to interlock with each other so that, for example, let me put it to you this way. If we're just talking about capital as a single number, well, to say the economy has $10 trillion of capital, whether you have a trillion screwdrivers that are $1 each and 9 trillion screws that are $1 each, I mean, that would be $10 trillion of capital. Or you could have different proportions, or you could have nothing but screwdrivers, or you could have screwdrivers and hammers and saws and nails, and you see what I'm saying? That to actually have a capital structure that interlocks with each other and everything flows so that resources get transformed step by step from raw materials into semi-finished goods, into almost goods that are almost ready for the consumer. So now they just get the box put on, they're put on the shelf with the price sticker, and then finally the customer puts it in his cart and takes it out to the car. I mean, you have to have a very particular combination of different types of goods to make that work. And so to just aggregate all that into a single number called capital, and then to think, in order to keep the economy humming, we just got to make sure that investment spending is high enough each period. I mean, that's crazy. You can't even talk about the Austrian diagnosis of what happens in a business cycle if you're just talking about, gee, how much capital is there in the economy right now? That doesn't work. Okay, so that's what Hayek is getting at here, is that if you pull back the camera basically to outer space, and so that all you can really see is how much total capital there is, and all you know is how much total labor there is, and maybe, you know, what percentage of the workforce is working or not, and that's really all you know, that's not enough. That you need to zoom in much more closely and see how many workers are working at mines bringing copper and tin to the surface, and then how many workers are processing those materials, and how many workers are making sandwiches for people at Subway, and so forth. You see that you got to look at it in terms of stages of production, and it's not enough to say, oh, is there investment going on? No, the investment has to be balanced in order for the economy to be sustainable. If you have everybody concentrating on making hammers and nobody's making any nails, that's going to lead to a problem pretty soon. It's not enough just to say, oh, we're investing in investment goods. We're producing goods that will help workers down the road. You need to make sure you're doing processes that are all mutually compatible. And the point is, you can't even get into that if you're just focusing on aggregate figures like the Keynesian system does. Okay, Hayek talks about what I'm calling the perversity of calling it a general theory. So the way he, before I get to this quote, so this excerpt comes out of Tiger by the Tail, that chapter that I gave you guys, the context here, how Hayek leads up to this statement, it's pretty harsh, is he says that what Keynes does, and this goes along with his focus on aggregates, he says, Keynes also makes the mistake of taking these variables that may have, in a certain period, borne a certain relationship to each other, like a statistical relationship, or that when one went up, the other one went up, and so forth, and then Keynes assumes that there was a functional relationship there, that there was causality, that just because looking over a certain time period from the past, looking at the statistics, we saw that consumption did this while investment did this, and therefore Keynes is going to lock that down and assume that that's a fixed relationship, and that now the government can implement policies taking that fixed cause and effect relationship into account when maybe that correlation breaks down in other circumstances, and maybe even the sign changes. And so the way Hayek talks about that is, he says, for example, it may be true that if you start from a depressed economy where there's a lot of unemployment and unemployed resources in general, it may be true if you take a snapshot of that and measure the aggregates like total consumption spending and total investment spending, and then you look ahead a few years to when the economy is in full recovery, and then you take a snapshot then, you could look at total consumption spending and total investment spending, you might erroneously conclude that, oh, in general, consumption and investment move in the same direction. And that's exactly what Keynes does do in his work. that, you know, Keynes, I don't think this was in the part that I gave you guys, but there's passages in the General Theory where Keynes says the classical theory is totally wrong, because the classical theory teaches that in order to have more investment spending, you need less consumption. But actually, it's the other way around. That why would anybody invest unless he thought there'd be demand for the finished product? So Keynes is saying when people spend more on consumption, that gives business people the confidence to go out and invest in expanding their operations. And so actually we see consumption and investment moving in the same direction. So Hayek is saying, yeah, sometimes consumption and investment might move in the same direction, but you're fooling yourself if you look at that for some period and assume that that's a stable relationship, because in fact, if we're at full employment, the economy, those things are going to have to move in opposite directions. That if you want to get more investment spending, the only way to do that once you're at full employment is for consumption to fall. So so then Hayek says, so he acknowledges what the obvious Keynesian response is. So what the Keynesian response is to say, no, Hayek, you're wrong. We are presenting the general theory. It's you classical economists who are locked in your own world, and you think that what that you're just focusing on the special case. So yeah, Hayek, you're right. If you're at that wall, if you're at that that corner point at full employment, yes, for that knife edge case, consumption and investment move in opposite directions. That's true. But anywhere else, it's not true. And you can, you know, you have the freedom, the flexibility to increase both consumption and investment, because there are idle resources that you can then fold back into use. So Hayek's responding to that, and he's saying, no, that's wrong, because look, you guys are calling it a general theory, but that's wrong. You're throwing out economics. So let me read this quotation, then I'll put it in the context. So this is Hayek talking about the Keynesian system. But the assumption that all goods and factors are available in excess makes the whole price system redundant, undetermined, and unintelligible. Indeed, some of the most orthodox disciples of Keynes appear consistently to have thrown overboard all the traditional theory of price determination and of distribution, all that used to be the backbone of economic theory, and in consequence, in my opinion, to have ceased to understand any economics. So what he had said a few paragraphs before this is he's saying it's not right for the Keynesians to say we have the general theory that's true for anything, and then we can also handle as a special limiting case full employment. Because Hayek is saying, even when the economy is at 95% employment, the principles that the so-called classicals developed still generally hold. You know, they might not, you know, you might have to amend them a little bit, but the basic relationships are still there. Things like trade-offs and opportunity cost and the way prices work and how price signals between relative prices between different sectors cause resources to flow from one sector to the other. He said, that stuff is all still true, even at less than full employment. And he said, but the Keynesians don't recognize that. They seem to think that what we all know of as economic theory, that all of our understanding of how markets work, they think that that stuff just works at full employment, and they throw it out the window whenever there's even mild unemployment. And so Hayek thinks that's wrong, that they're really just throwing out economics itself and then having the audacity to say they're replacing it with a more general theory, when he says, no, you guys are throwing out what we've learned about the economy. And I have to say, I mean, I think that's true. I mean, Paul Krugman is really just a great example of this. It's shocking to me the stuff he is willing to say because we're in a liquidity trap. It's not just stuff like, oh, it's okay to run big deficits, but he also says things like, it doesn't matter what the government spends the money on. He said, yeah, ideally the government would spend it on useful things, but the government could literally pay people to dig holes and fill them up again, and that would be better than not spending the money. All right, so now, you know, frugality doesn't matter when there's a liquidity trap, apparently. And then Krugman even says tariffs might be a good idea when there's a liquidity trap. All right, so it's, again, just all the, you know, so mercantilism now works at less than full employment. So this is, you know, giving proof to what Hayek is talking about here, that it's not just that they tweak certain little policy prescriptions. It's that they think what we know of as solid economic reasoning, that apparently all goes out the window whenever we're at less than full employment. And if, in fact, you're viewing full employment as sort of a knife-edge case, then basically you're throwing out economics. Okay, hang on. Let me just jump ahead here because I have to remind myself. Okay, I said to remind myself how many slides we got left. Okay, so now we're on slide D, Hayek on wage rigidities. So here he makes a few points. Let me just emphasize them. So one thing is he wants to distinguish between the overall level of wages and relative wages. So this ties in with his complaint about Keynes focusing on aggregates. Hayek is saying, look, usually, in most cases, the issue is not whether wages in general are too high. The issue is not whether labor needs to accept lower wages. The issue is certain sectors have expanded too much, or certain sectors, you know, need to contract, or certain sectors are the ones that should expand, and it takes relative price and wage adjustments in order to get resources out of the bloated sectors and into the deficient sectors. And so to talk about just the aggregate level of the wage rate, gee, are wages too high or too low, makes that same mistake of just looking at macro aggregates when the crucial thing in terms of understanding the economy is disaggregating it and looking at individual sectors. So you shouldn't be talking about the wage rate. You should be talking about wages in different sectors. And then he says that maybe Great Britain in the 1920s was the one example where the Keynesian system might have made sense. That there, for the reasons we talked about at the beginning of this lecture, you might have been able to say with a straight face that, yes, all workers need to take a wage cut, or all workers need to see their real wages go down, perhaps, you know, through letting the pound depreciate. But other than that, Hayek thinks it's a sectoral story. It's not about the whole economy, all the workforce having their wages be either too high or too low. Another thing that Hayek says, and this is a subtle point, so let me make sure you caught this. Hayek says that to the extent that trade unions backed up by government can prevent the free fluctuation of wage rates, and so they're crippling the ability of relative wages to adjust. So when I say relative wages, I mean that wages in one sector rise or fall compared to some other sector. So when you lock in wages and make it hard for them to move down, Hayek's point is not only does that mean the aggregate wage level now is rigid downward, which is obvious, but he's saying it cripples the ability of the economy to adapt. The economy now is less efficient because now if there's just little changes, like let's say consumer demand switches from cigarettes to novels, before, how would the market economy deal with that? Well, the wages of tobacco farmers would go down and the wages of book publishers would go up. And so you'd have workers leaving agriculture and going into book publishing, or, you know, you could pick something more plausible. But you get the idea. If people stop eating so much at Chinese restaurants and they move to Thai restaurants, how would the market respond? Well, the wages paid to waiters and dishwashers and so forth in the Chinese restaurant sector would go down, so workers would leave those jobs and they would get hired in the Thai restaurant sector, or whatever I said, I don't remember what I said, because those wages would go up. So that's the way you would allocate resources among different industries or sectors. That's how you get people to move to where they should be going. But if now we just lock it down so that nobody's wages anywhere can ever go down, the Keynesians think, oh, that's a problem if there's a big drop in the price level. But Hayek's point is, it's not only a problem there, it's also a problem just when little things change here and there. And in fact, since it makes the economy less efficient, that means the productivity of labor in general is lower than it otherwise would be. And it has to be the case that if we're not shuffling workers around as easily as we were before to where they're needed most, then total output's going to be lower than it otherwise would be. So for every hour of work that's put into things, there's less product to go around, right? So the productivity of labor in general is lower if unions make wage adjustments impossible or make downward wage adjustments impossible. And so what that means then is the, if you want to think of it in terms of aggregates, the level of the real wages necessary to get full employment now is lower because of the inefficiency, right? Because labor is less productive. So let me put it another way. If unions weren't crippling the labor market, workers in general would be more productive. So that means they could justifiably be paid a higher real wage. And so it would be easier to clear the labor market. Because the problem is, you know, what happens if aggregate demand isn't enough for the employers to be able to pay workers a wage high enough to get full employment, given that workers refuse to work for too little wages? Hayek's point is, by having the workers refuse to take pay cuts, you're actually making the economy less productive, meaning the workers aren't worth as much. So you're just exacerbating the problem. Okay, the last slide, and then I'll turn over to your questions, is on those dueling letters. And here, let me pull those up. Okay, so I'm just looking these things over. In case you guys don't have it in front of you, I'll post the URL in the chat box. Okay, so that's where it is. So here, let's just look this over. So I think this is pretty self-explanatory, but let me just make some comments. So we've got this first letter from McGregor, Pigou, Keynes, Leighton, Salter, and Stamp, and they're saying that it's not true to say that there needs to be economy, and by that they mean like frugality, like to cut back on your consumption spending and to save is what they mean by economy here. So they say, when a man economizes in consumption and lets the fruit of his economy pile up in a bank balance or even in the purchase of existing securities, the released real resources do not find a new home waiting for them. In the present conditions, their entry into investment is blocked by lack of confidence. Moreover, private economy intensifies the block, for it further discourages all those forms of investment, factories, machines, and so forth, whose ultimate purpose is to make consumption goods. Consequently, in present conditions, private economy does not transfer from consumption to investment part of an unchanged national real income. On the contrary, it cuts down the national income by nearly as much as it cuts down consumption. All right, so this is just the epitome of what we now call Keynesian economics. And so let me just put those in different words and tie it back to what Keynes does in the general theory. And notice, this letter was written in 1932. All right, so keep that in mind. Keynes in the general theory, which came out in 36, was not inventing something from scratch. He was just codifying this train of thought that had been going on for some time. All right, so the way Keynes presents it, his critique of the orthodox economist and the general theory, and you see it in this letter too, is to say the mistake that David Ricardo and others, so-called classical economists, made is they were taking the level of output as given, and then they were just looking at the principles of relative prices and other conditions that determined what share of the national income went to the workers and went to the capitalists and so on. And the same thing, even in more modern times, economists who are in the tradition of the classicals, they're assuming that the market's always going to clear and maximize output, and then they're just wondering, okay, what determines how much Bill Gates gets, or what determines how much Tiger Woods gets, or determines how much a guy, the janitor in a building gets, and they say, oh, marginal productivity, that sort of thing. So we have these principles of distribution, of income distribution and so on, and we also have this idea that, oh, if you save, then that will lead to investment spending, because they're thinking erroneously, according to Keynes and others. The classical economists are thinking that total output's always going to be what it is, because total income is what it is, and all income is going to be spent in one form or another, and so ultimately if one person saves more, there must be more investment spending somewhere in consequence of it. That if you save, you were going to go out to dinner, but now you don't, well, you just freed up some real resources. The labor that the waiter was going to use in sitting you down and serving you, the food that was going to go into the making of your meal, the hot water that was going to be used to clean your dishes and so on, that stuff is now all freed up because you're choosing not to consume. And so in principle, those extra resources ought to get deployed to making a tractor or something to make the economy more productive. But what those guys are saying in that letter is that's actually not true in general. And especially right now, in the midst of this awful depression, because they're writing this in 1932, they're saying if people save more, that they're not just changing the composition of the national income. It's not that they're turning consumption into investment and leaving national income the same. He says, rather, they're reducing national income. That, yeah, their consumption goes down, but there's no investment anywhere that necessarily goes up to offset it. And so all that happens is total income shrinks. So I think that's the best way to put it. Let me just say that one more time because it's important. Keynes is saying that the classical school of thought is wrong because it looks at an individual household and then thinks that it can just engage in composition to get to the whole economy. So an individual household is thinking, okay, here's my income that my employer, you know, I have my job, my employer gives me my paycheck, so I know what my income is, and I can either consume it, spend it on consumption, or I can save it. And my decision to consume or invest doesn't change my income. My income is what it is, and then out of my income, I can consume or save. And my consumption plus savings equals my income. And so if I consume less, I save more. Great. And that makes me better off, like, you know, going down the road. That's far-sighted behavior. And Keynes is saying the crucial thing to realize is you can't generalize from that. You can't take that individual household and then multiply it for all the households in the country and say that the country as a whole has a given income, and it is what it is, and then out of that they can either consume some or save some. He's saying that's wrong, because what you're missing is the fact that when you withhold your, when you cut your own spending and save more, you just knock down somebody else's income in the community. And unless your saving translates into increased investment spending, that loss isn't made up anywhere in the system. So even though from an individual household's point of view, your saving and investment behavior doesn't affect your income, your income is just some number out of which you save or invest, Keynes is saying that's not true for the economy as a whole. We shouldn't assume that national output is just some number based on how much machinery we have and how many trained workers we have, and then out of that we can allocate it towards investment or consumption. He's saying that's not right, that if people clam up and stop spending, then national income might shrink accordingly. And then, so remember, Keynes believes savings equals investment. But his point is, if people try to save more, they might ultimately be frustrated in the aggregate because that might just make income shrink. So investment is whatever it is, and savings will equal that. And so if people are trying to save more, like a higher fraction of their income, the way you maintain the equality between savings and investment is for total income to shrink, so that the higher proportion that you're saving equals the absolute dollar amount of how much total investment spending is going to be. And so again, just keep that in mind, that you may have been confused. You may have thought that Keynes would think savings could be higher than investment. And no, he doesn't. He thinks it all, the accounting works to balance it out. But his point is, don't take income as being fixed and then think if you save more, that means investment must go up. That's not what he thinks. He thinks investment is whatever it is because of animal spirits and that kind of stuff. So if you save more, if you try to save more, meaning a higher fraction of your income, then the only way to make the equations balance is for income to shrink. And he, in the way you see that, well, you know, what's the cause and effect? How does that manifest itself? Well, when you stop going out to eat, the restaurant's income just went down. Their revenues just fell. And so that's one person in the economy whose income dropped because of your decision not to spend. Okay, so what's the response of Hayek and who else? Some guy, Gregory, don't know who that is, and then Arnold Plant and Lionel Robbins, who are big free market guys. They are saying they have three things. I'm already dipping into your Q&A time, so let me just say this very quickly. So they say there's three things, whether to use money or whether to hoard it, whether to spend money, by which they mean spend it on consumption, or whether to invest it, and then whether government investment is on all fours with investment by private individuals. So they're trying to say that the Keynesians are wrong for looking at it, for slicing and dicing the issue in terms of spending or saving. And Hayek is saying that that's not really, that there's a lot of stuff going on. So the first point is pretty subtle, and I just want to point out that not all Austrians would agree with Hayek on this one. So the first point is the issue of, you know, so we have a certain income in the form of money. Now what are we going to do with that? Are we going to spend it in some way, or are we going to just hoard it, meaning accumulate it in our cash balances? And so these writers do agree with the Keynesians in this point. They're saying, yeah, if people are just letting their cash balances grow, we agree that's not helping anything right now, because then that just would be further deflationary pressures, and that's not good. All right, so again, that's what Hayek is saying here, but I just want to make sure you guys don't get misled. Murray Rothbard would not necessarily endorse that. All right, so Rothbard, if people want to increase their cash balances, engage in hoarding, Rothbardians in general don't have a problem with that. They don't think that that's somehow antisocial in contrast to other things you might do with your money. Okay, now the second issue, they're saying whether just to consume it or invest it, and they're saying, we on the contrary believe that one of the main difficulties of the world today is the deficiency of investment, a depression of the industries making for capital extension, etc. All right, so this ties in with the Austrian view of the economy being in different sectors. All right, so what they're saying is, no, there is a problem of investment, and the way we're going to get out of this thing, you know, part of the problem is investment has been paralyzed in the capital goods industries. And in order for us to get out of this, we have to go back and start replenishing the capital stock. And the only way to do that is for people to save and then invest in replenishing those, so we can, you know, fix the structure of production and get back to a sustainable level of growth. And then the third point they're saying is the government investment is not at all the same thing as private investment. So this is yet another problem with the Keynesian macro approach. The Keynesian system just looks at investment spending, whether or not it's done by politicians or by private individuals or corporations. So the point there is that, well, no, those things aren't the same, and it makes a big difference whether it is the public investing money privately versus the government investing money. And then they conclude by saying, you know, we're not recommending the government do nothing. We're saying there's a lot the government could do, in particular freeing up the movement of capital and international trade. Because remember, there was the Smoot-Hawley tariff, and then all the reciprocal trade war shots being fired at this point. So international trade plummeted in the early 1930s. Now there's an open question as to, was it just because of the depression, or was it also because of all the countries jacking up tariffs on each other? And, you know, how are you going to disentangle that? I don't know. But the point is, tariff rates went up across the board quite significantly in the major countries. And so these guys are saying that's one of the reasons we're in such bad shape right now. Okay, why don't I stop there, and I'll turn over to your questions, and I got to load it up here. And just to let you know, I actually am going to have to end it, I think, 35 after, because we, as many of you know, we have the back doubleheader tonight. That right after this, at the top of the hour, I'm going to start the second man economy and state class. So I need to let my batteries recharge. Okay, so this is week 4. Okay, Mark Pretty says, what was the general response of academic economists to the general theory at the time it was published? Was it initially viewed as positively as it later became? I'm trying to understand why the economists of the day, who are mostly supposed to be of the classicist variety, did not put up more of a fight in terms of criticizing Keynes. I know Hayek and others pointed to his flaws. I'm just wondering why criticism was not more widespread in economic journals and the like. Well, as Jonathan mentions, there was a lot of criticism at the time. And Hayek, as you know, well, actually, I don't remember if he said it in the interview that I gave you guys or relate, because you know how YouTube has related videos, and I was clicking around last night when I was looking at the video I gave you guys, so I don't remember where he said this, but at one point he said something like, look, I know this is going to sound conceited and self-serving, but this is really how it went down. In the 1930s, Keynes and I were like the big deals. You know, Keynes was the representative of the interventionist, and I was sort of the free market guy. I'm obviously paraphrasing here, everyone, but we were considered, you know, the leaders of certain schools of thought that were respectable, and you know, we went head to head, and there was a healthy, vigorous debate. And then he says, and afterwards, then when Keynes died, he became a martyr, or no, he said a saint after his death for some reason. And then when Hayek says he published The Road to Serfdom, then nobody took him seriously anymore. Like that was Hayek's, the end of Hayek being considered a serious academic economist, because The Road to Serfdom was considered, you know, I guess that would be like the equivalent of him being a guest host on Glenn Beck or something, which is actually kind of funny since Glenn Beck recently touted The Road to Serfdom and made it go up to like number 2 or something on Amazon. Okay, so so that's what Hayek said. So given that he talked that way, makes me think that the general theory, and remember Hayek also said when it first came out, Hayek didn't think it was going to be a big deal. That's why he didn't bother putting a lot of energy into fighting it. So, I mean, I haven't studied this question too much, so I don't know with that much confidence, but just based on Hayek's reaction to that question, my guess is that, yeah, at the time, people didn't realize that the general theory was going to be as big a deal as it ended up being in retrospect. And then also, I think part of it, too, could have just been that the fact of who Keynes was. That if you saw the part in The Tiger by the Tail, I mean, Hayek talks about how Keynes was a hero to liberals, by which I mean like classical liberals, people who were devoted to peace, because of his work criticizing the Treaty of Versailles. And so, you know, if you think about this, that was a very noble thing for Keynes to do, because he was influential at the time. So for him to say that the peace treaty that his own government had been instrumental in creating was unfair to the people that were attacking their country. Right? So that's kind of a noble gesture, a very, you know, citizen of the world type thing. So I think that had something to do with it. I think if some other academic had written the general theory, it probably would not have been as influential, but because it was Keynes, I think that and the other thing too, I mean, Keynes is a brilliant guy. I mean, just you read in the book, like I say, if you had the physical general theory and you know, oh gee, there's no way I can read this thing cover to cover, it's too hard. Okay, that's fine, but just flip through it. And he, you know, in the footnotes and stuff, I mean, he clearly is very well-read, or widely read, I should say, because you're right, to say well-read means he grasped it. So, I mean, it's if you didn't know any better, you would walk away thinking, oh my gosh, this guy's one of the most amazing economists ever because of the audacity of what he's trying to do in that book. So even if there were particular things that didn't quite work out, so people could say, you know, in the journals, well, wait a minute, Keynes says this, but there's a problem because, but nonetheless, I can understand why people would walk away saying, oh, okay, those are some minor details, the little quibbles that he got wrong with the exposition, but I mean, the grand scope of what he's trying to do here, I mean, this is an amazing system that he's giving us. You know, that's, I think that's partly what was going on there. And there was so much that he put into it, just his observations about how the stock market worked and things like that, that I think it was going to be a classic work no matter what. And then especially as time went on, it just got elevated to a classic. Okay, Paul King says, and then this is going to have to be the last question, and I will, I've got it on my calendar. I was traveling a lot and I fell behind, but I will catch up with you guys if you have questions from previous weeks too. That slips through the cracks, I'll get all caught up in the next few days on that. Okay, so Paul King says, in the letters to the Times, both Keynes and Hayek and their co-authors refer to bank deposits preventing money from reaching investment. And then King quotes them, and he says, however, Rothbard and the mystery of banking suggests the first nail in the coffin for the separation of deposit and loan banking was in 1811. So why do both groups think money on deposit in the banking system won't flow into investment? Is it that pre-1932 time and site deposits were still ubiquitous and distinct and that site deposits were by far the most popular? Is that what they are referring to? No. I don't. I think you're talking about two different things here, Paul. So this doesn't really have to do with fractional reserve banking, which I think is what you're getting at. So you earn income and you want to save it, and I think what Hayek is saying is, if you save it by going out and then buying some new machinery and then using that to try to produce something that you're going to sell 2 years later, you're saving it and investing it yourself. So clearly you're still spending the money. But if instead you just get it and you let your cash balances grow and you go and give it to a bank, and even if you buy like a CD, a certificate of deposit, so that's not money to you now, but that's in the form of, well, actually, I see what you're saying, Paul. You're right. They are specifically making it sound like you're talking about cash balances, and so how could those be lent out? I get what you're saying, but my hunch is just that, no, they're not making a point here about fractional reserve banking, that I think you could paraphrase it and say, even if they put their money in a true savings account, even though you're right, technically we shouldn't classify that as cash balances anymore, because no, you have a CD, you don't have money. That's true. I still think that Keynes and Hayek are saying, we don't know that the bank would be able to lend that out necessarily. So I think that's what they're getting. The point being, if you save in some form where you're not directly investing yourself in terms of buying productive equipment, then there is that loose joint, and it's not clear that your abstention from consumption is necessarily going to prod someone to engage in real investment activity. And so in the classical approach, that automatically happens, that if you save and put the money with the bank, then now because the supply of loanable funds goes up, the interest rate goes down, and that stimulates more investment spending, that more firms go to the bank to borrow more money, which they then spend on investment. So that's, and Keynes is saying, No, we don't know that that's going to happen. So you're right. There is a little problem there because in the conventional story, wait a minute, if people save more and give their money to the bank, how can the bank lend it out unless we're talking about fraction reserve banking? Yeah, that is going on, but I don't think that's really the issue here. You're right. It is a complication to the story, but I don't think that Keynes and Hayek's views are turning on the issue of whether we have 100% or fraction reserve banking. Okay, so I got to stop there because, like I say, I have to get ready for the next class. So for those of you who are I see, Paul, that maybe I'm misunderstanding your question. So if you want to clarify in that thread, Paul, I'll come back to you, but maybe I'm not getting maybe what you're asking. Okay, so we got to stop there. Maybe I'll see some of you in about 23 minutes. And otherwise, for those of you who are just taking this class, remember to do your multiple choice on Friday and do the readings for next week. I'm not going to be able to have office hours again this week because I'm at another conference, this one that I'm hosting in Nashville. So I think I'm going to have to miss office hours again, but I'll send out an email to confirm that. Okay, thanks.